It's the show Agent Orange / Adolf Twitler would love to shut down.
So here's the story, folks. I am the least black person that you've ever seen in your entire life. In fact, we did very well relative to racist people.
It's the no bullshit zone.
It's called fake news.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
I know who you are. Just wait.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Oh boy, today do we have a lot to cover, including polls, Pelosi, pressure, impeachment, presidential persecution, and traveling around the world with unpolished potentates. Whew, that's a lot to cover. And we'll get to all of that, I swear, today during the course of the show. Before we do that, hi, welcome to my program. I'm, of course, your host, critical thinker, problem solver, guy that is so busy that I forgot to mention I pulled a car apart last week and hurt myself severely. My name is Shaggy Jenkins. You can find me at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, on iHeart. You can find me on the app, Spotify, iTunes, and whatever. Oh, but you know, just look for a Shaggy Jenkins Show. My correspondent today joins us from a place that is, dare I say, more southern than where I'm from. Just geographically speaking. Please welcome the very, very hot and humid Drew Landry.
What's up, man? It's good to be back.
Oh, I know. And this week, let's just go ahead and say, besides what's happening in the news, the weather seems to be matching the political climate. It is hot as Hades.
You're exactly right. You know, there's some humidity and some pressure going on. We're seeing this high pressure area coming from the left.
Yeah. Specifically out of Iowa today seems to be a very high pressure area, and that's kind of where I want to start off with a little bit of a weather check of the Democratic 2020 candidates. Sorry, 22 candidates. There's 18 candidates now. There's not 22 yet, are there?
I know that we're north of 20.
Okay, so yeah.
If we get to 30, I think I'm just going to throw my hat in there and just say that, you know, just to get my name on there.
Yeah, I think I lost count right around when Cory Booker's ficus decided to run.
Yeah.
But, Drew, let's talk about some of our field of contenders, because since he entered into the race, a lot of people have been really putting the pressure on one Joe Biden and saying, Biden, he's our guy. If he can't do it, we don't fly. And that's not really resonating too much as time goes on with the base of the Democratic Party. So how do you start in such a very likable position like a Joe Biden and end up kind of lukewarm way before the race even starts now?
Well, I think a lot of people have known about Joe Biden. I mean, we've talked about him on this show before. And we've talked about how, you know, how the Trump people have been going out to try, get information on him. The thing is that, you know, Biden's been in the political life for over 40 years. So it's not that hard to find information on him. And, we mentioned about how a simple Google search could help with that. But we have also, I mean, you've jokingly said, you know, Joe Biden with a mullet is not exactly helpful either. But I think that would be quite comical. But look, the former vice president, former senator, has had a long history of saying things and just kind of putting his foot in his mouth that, you know, all this type of stuff that really comes back and really haunts him. That's really the double-edged sword of having so much experience, is that you do something, you know, 25, 30 years ago and it comes back that maybe that really wasn't the best thing to really do. So that's kind of where he's finding himself right now, is, you know, people are kind of ho-hum, like, yeah, he's okay, but, you know, this was really his primary to lose, and he's, you know, truth be told, he's been in the lead of every poll that's been taken so far. But what we're seeing is that, you know, a little bit of dwindling down of his lead, and it could be for the fact that, you know, maybe he's, you know, been in it too long, maybe he's, you know, too old. But if you look at some of the other people, they're almost around his age. So I don't think the age question is much of a factor. But I do want to make mention of his sudden interesting stance on what's called the Hyde Amendment, trying to limit women's access to abortions in a lot of ways. And so, this is, you know, his flip-flop, his stance, the nonsense, and it's just confusing. So this is probably where some enthusiasm has kind of gotten soft on him. But in the last poll that was released out of Iowa, he has the most support right now in June, okay? And the Iowa caucus isn't until January, which, you know, be that as it may. But, you know, but his is a little less than a quarter of the support. In second place is Bernie Sanders, as that's where the first two have always been. It's been Biden and Sanders. But what's ever so interesting is the rising involvement or the rising popularity of Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator. And it seems like she has a plan for everything, and she's even going to help somebody get a date, as it was reported on social media. So, you know, it's a bit interesting here. We're seeing a little bit of dwindling down of Joe Biden, seeing a rise of Elizabeth Warren, and we'll continue to see how this goes further.
Now, this is the thing about Elizabeth Warren's, dare I say, sudden popularity. Yeah. Because, okay, look, for people that actually follow politics, Elizabeth Warren is kind of a long-term player and has actually squared off against Joe Biden in the past before, right before we contributed and made this branch of the government that she was supposed to be a part of, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This was actually Warren's baby, where she yep. tried to go after companies that were predatory practicing all on their base to make themselves very, very, very rich. She put right. in a system of way of making sure that creditors could not do predatory behavior. And as such, if a creditor or bank or institution of any financial type of dealings did something predatory, she made it actually easier for the victim of said crime not only to get out from under the debt, which once again was formed by predatory practices, but also make sure that we had a system of checks and balances to police and even fine and accuse of crimes companies that engaged in bad financial dealings. This right. was supposed to be something that saved our economy from the credit bubble. The second Trump comes along and denigrates the CFPB way to the back of the barrel, disempowers it, puts in a guy in charge of it that absolutely thinks it's the worst idea ever. Mm-hmm. Once that happened, Elizabeth Warren's beautiful plan for protecting us got thrown off. And I kind of want to say, Drew, that's her impetus for running, is she was like, you know what? I have tried since 1994. Mind you, 1994, to do something like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I finally got it in under the last administration, only for it to only be in power for 2 years before it was, you know, taken down by this quack job. So a lot of the things that I think that has her in this race right now is the fact that all of the things that we have been talking about the rise of American debt, about the staggering numbers of unemployment, how the tariffs and the trade wars are actually costing middle America into, and this is no joke, right now estimates hundreds of millions going into the year ahead. Now, with all of that said, is Elizabeth Warren's popularity really that hard to explain when literally the one thing that she has championed in D.C., like I said, once in front of Joe Biden himself, this thing that she championed, now that it's not being observed as much, it's not being treated with the respect that she thought it was, do you think that that's really the reason that she's out there and people are actually coming back to her and going, oh, damn, you had some really good ideas. We're sorry we forgot about that.
Yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, she's been in this for a long time. She's no newcomer to any of this. I mean, you know, she was also part of the faculty over at Harvard and dealing with this as well. I mean, she really took on, some people from the Clinton years, right, during all this, too. So, you know, so she has a long history of taking on the brokers and the dealers and those who really benefit the most from Wall Street, and let alone those who get their donations. So, this isn't anything new coming out of Elizabeth Warren, but it's the fact that people are looking at her now and really observing what she has to say. And, you know, hey, she has a plan for, you know, college debt. She has a plan for universal health care. She has a plan for this and this and this and this and this. And people are going, oh, my gosh, she's getting all of this plans. And that's really, really neat. So that can very well be a very interesting aspect as to why she's being propelled now and getting some momentum heading into the, you know, first caucus of the primary season. So, it's a bit of an interesting aspect as to why she's getting so much popularity. But we also have to remember that that some of the other candidates are getting some popularity and they haven't said anything at all. Like Pete Buttigieg, he says a lot of nice things and gets people kind of excited. He doesn't really have a plan for much of anything, let alone the fact neither does Joe Biden. I mean, he's recently come out with something and now it's like, oh, hey, great. So some of those who are at the top, quote unquote top, don't really have the fine details explaining how we connect X, Y, and Z like Senator Warren has. And I don't know if that's because that she's a woman. Maybe it is. Who knows? But, you know, people, even myself, thought, you know, she was done after the whole blood test thing that she did late last year or earlier this year, trying to prove she had some sort of aspect of Native American in her. But, you know, because, you know, the president always goes after and calls her Pocahontas, which is incredibly racist and incredibly stupid. But, you know, I shouldn't expect anything less coming out of this president. But let's also understand that she really gave into that. And so it was kind of like, well, you just, you know, really shouldn't have done that. But now she's kind of did a bit of a comeback here. And now she's rising in Iowa. That's great. And, you know, this could be a bit of a comeback for her. And that's, you know, be a tremendous victory for her if she continues on this path.
Now, let's talk about the people that are in the way of a Warren rise, though. Because for the most part, a lot of people kind of have thought that since Joe Biden has jumped in, this is going to come down to, once again, a white old man running up against the white old incumbent, all right? For the most part, Democrats, I mean, we try to be all inclusive and stuff on the left side in America, don't we? But a lot of political strategists go, hey, if we're going to beat the white guy, we need to run a white guy. And that's one of the things that's kind of been, well, for people like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, that's kind of been the glass ceiling that we thought, presumably, that they're going to hit well before we get into any serious competition. And I am not saying that as a misogynistic person. I am saying that because we come from a misogynistic and sexist nation. Deal with it. So back to the point of all of this, the thing is that Warren seems to be gaining ground even on, and I'm just going to label this for what it is, old white guy wisdom in the DNC.
Yeah.
Why is it over people like Pete Buttigieg, who did come forward and say, look, when it comes to abortion, I think that the question isn't where do we draw the line, it's who do we let draw the line, which was a great quote. When it came to Kamala Harris, her big plan is let's take all of these debates out of the judicial system and legislate them so therefore they're not arguments anymore. Cory Booker, of course, has said, I'm here to help, but also give me your money, big pharmaceutical companies. So there is that weird divide. you know, it's like, I want health care, but at the same time, has anybody met my friend GlaxoKline? But getting back to the whole point of this, with these candidates that are behind the presumptive leaders, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, we have not, up until this week, actually started to think very seriously about those first two positions being knocked off, have we?
No, we haven't. You hit the nail on the head. We've just kind of assumed here for the past couple of months that, well, it's going to come down to Biden and Sanders and you know, the Democrats are going to do what Democrats do, and that's make themselves mad, and then you piss off one half of them, and then the other half didn't want to show up for the election, and then we're stuck with Trump again. So, you know, that's, you know, there's this great quote from Will Rogers, and it's so applicable. He goes, I'm not part of a professional political party. I'm a Democrat. And it's so incredibly true, because that's just how this party has handled itself. And it frustrates so many people in it, because they want to see more inclusion, and they want to see more policies being done. And what Democrats have really been shy of is really, going full throttle, trying to be more rational, as opposed to, radical Republicans on issues like abortion and guns and even health care. There's no question here that we have seen for the past month. We just thought, everybody thought, well, it's going to, well, Biden's in it. It's probably going to be Biden, or it's going to come down to Bernie and Biden and all this and that. We didn't really give much thought to an uptick to Elizabeth Warren. Didn't really think, give serious consideration to Kamala Harris or even to Pete Buttigieg. Didn't really give that kind of thought there. It's interesting that, you know, we see that the quote unquote front runner of Biden, his support dwindling down, and we're seeing the others. I don't know if they're so much taking his support, but they're going upwards. Now, there's still those who are having problems, like former congressman from El Paso, Beto O'Rourke. He's still having problems getting out there in Iowa, even though he's made many, many trips to Iowa, crisscrossing that state. You know, he's only polling at about 2%. Senator Amy Klobuchar is having problems getting any kind of name recognition. These types of candidates are really having a tough time, really making themselves be known. I mean, even New York City Mayor de Blasio polling at 0%. The question that we can really ask here is, how useful is this poll come January? Well, right now, what we're doing is we're tracking where these candidates are in time. They're going to run, there's going to be more polls. The poll industry isn't going anywhere. Okay. So let's understand this. We just kind of have to get used to this. So there's going to be another one next month. And as time gets closer to Iowa, we can really take stock, and we can really see where someone even back in June was gaining ground, or way back in June was losing ground. So that's one of the big points about this. And not to mention the fact that, if you're Elizabeth Warren and you're gaining ground, you can send out an email to your people and say, hey, can you send me $10? Can you send me $25? It's really good fundraising material here. So that's always something that these polls are really useful for. So let's just understand that the original part here was, did we consider anybody else a couple months ago? The answer is no. But it's interesting to see how the field has widened. And maybe that'll make for an interesting primary. Maybe it'll live up to the ongoing stereotype that Democrats don't have their crap together. Maybe it'll be all those things and make a very strong candidate that the Democrats will put out next summer.
Yeah, well, because this is the thing. I always wanted to ask, like, way ahead of a next presidential race, this question: how much, honestly, do we actually learn from polls at this stage? Because if I'm, and I don't want to mean like us, like me and you, Drew, because nobody cares about us. Let's talk about us, a politician. Because that's what everybody cares about right now, right? It's all about the politician.
Sure.
So
sure.
If you're a politician, if you are a Elizabeth Warren, this far away from game day, I mean, we haven't even went into summer camp. We haven't done our recruitment drives yet. We have not went to the draft. We're not in preseason. This far away from the big, big game, what do you, as a politician, truthfully glean from polls like this?
Oh, you take this, and if you've been written off, if you've been just an afterthought, and you come in with 14% of the vote, and you've been having the year, well, 14% polling, and you've been having the year that you've been having that hasn't been that great, you think this is fantastic. You think, hey, this is a really good thing. This is momentum. We got to keep it up. If you're Joe Biden and you see this, you go, well, you know, what the heck's going on? But at the same time, we still have work to do. And that's the ongoing phrase that you're going to hear from Sanders, and you're going to hear from, you know, Buttigieg and many others. Just recently, Beto O'Rourke was asked about, well, you're only polling at 2% in Iowa. Shouldn't you really just kind of throw it away or whatever? And he's like, look, I never did any polls to begin with. If I ever did, I would never be a congressman. I wouldn't have ever given a competitive race to Ted Cruz. So, polls are what they are. Truth be told, if you're Elizabeth Warren, this is great news for you. If you're still stuck in neutral and trying to get above some 8-9%, 7%, you realize that things could be worse, but you have more work to do. If you're below 5% right now, you really have to look yourself in the mirror and go, is this the time for me to really do this? Should I really do this? So that's kind of what you can learn from, if you're the politician, that's your voice right now.
You've done this before. So yeah. Maybe I should ask for your own experience. When it came to polls, did they make you change your policy or at least your presentation of your policy?
Well, there's many things about me that I had to change, or at least work on. And one thing that I've never admitted on here, but it's been quite I don't say quite apparent, but it has happened at times, that I have a slight stutter. So I've had to not talk so fast. I've had to be less useful of my hands, as sometimes that will happen whenever I speak. That's a teacher thing. But, learning how to speak in front of crowds is something that you just have to really learn. Whenever we do polling, we'll ask certain questions. Is this the issue that we want to deal with? Or is this what we need to talk about more? So there's many, many things. I mean, this is kind of like getting your report card. Where do I need to have improvement? Where do I need to, hold off? Maybe I shouldn't talk so much about this issue. Or maybe I shouldn't, when I wear this particular color, I probably shouldn't wear that anymore because I look ridiculous. Believe it or not, that happens. So appearance does matter, and it truly does, and because, people are fickle. So, that's kind of what you always have to really bear in mind, is that you when you submit yourself to a poll, you're asking for feedback. And, if your name recognition is low, that means you have to work harder and get people to know, to recognize your name with the name that'll be on the ballot. So that's a pretty long answer to your question. I apologize for that. But understand that it's a very difficult process. And there are times when you have to look yourself in the mirror and go, can I do this? Do I really have to talk more about issue X? I may not be comfortable talking about issue X, but if that's what people in this area want me to talk about, and if I want to represent them, that's something that you have to wrestle with.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like being the host of this show. I don't want to talk about Trump again. Why do I have to talk about him? Crap, that's what the people want to hear. Here we go. So a lot of ways, being a politician is exactly like being on this radio program.
In some ways, it is.
Wow. Well, because I've got like 60 seconds here, I kind of want to know, though, based on these early kind of numbers, do people in the back, and I just want to specifically mention three because they seem to be the media darlings right now, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg, do they have a chance of placing in the top five?
Yes. At this point, There's still a lot of work to be done. Yes, they do. All three that you mentioned there are working incredibly hard, going to as many places as they possibly can. So, getting their message out. Right now, of those three, you're seeing a lot more attention to Elizabeth Warren than what we have in a long, long time. And there are Democrats out there who will say, hey, it's not Joe Biden, and this is somebody who actually has some plans. This might be something that we can pay attention to and really get something from.
Mm, yeah, because when it comes to Bernie Sanders right now, he's just there going, what about me? Why did you guys forget about me? I went to Walmart last week. They thought I was a door greeter. Come on, people. I mean, which, by the way, I know I've only got like 20 seconds here, but can I just say good on Bernie Sanders for what he did, taking over a employee's position at a Walmart board hearing just so he could get up there and say, you guys are bums. You take everybody's money. You don't pay living wages. You're bums. Oh, gosh. All right. I got to take a quick break on that. One, because I think I've hurt something in my throat. And two, because we have to. We'll be back in a sec. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back to it. Oh boy, did we cover a lot in our first section. And as a matter of fact, we actually talked about a lot during our break. And if you ever want to see that kind of stuff, well, you got to follow me on social media at Shaggy Live. Joining me from the District of West Texas, who, according to my wife, would be deep in the heart of Gilead if he were to, if things were to continue going the way they're going. Please welcome not a Marta. He is a Drew. Drew Landry.
Hey, let's dig in.
Yeah, I know the new season of The Handmaid's Tale is out. And as such, this weekend for me was a little bit of a marathon. Because I like depressing things that could possibly be more true than we make them out to be. With that said, this is kind of one of those weeks where the dystopian nature of the government inside, or should I say the diplomacy depicted inside of The Handmaid's Tale, has actually made it to the outside real world. In as such, the GOP, which has become Trump's personal army, the GOP, just going into Friday and especially into this week, has started to have a little break with the president over one issue. And this issue is kind of a sticky issue. Drew, what's the issue?
Yeah, it's dealing with Saudi Arabia and the arms deal. This has been really interesting here to see how senators and members of the U.S. House have not gone by party lines. This has been a bipartisan approach to really try to get a nuclear arms, well, any type of arms deal, I shouldn't say nuclear, but any type of arms deal that the president and the executive branch wants to do, to bring it to a vote in the halls of the U.S. Congress. You're seeing both Republicans and Democrats alike opposing this, and let alone the fact that just a few months ago, they voted to cease U.S. Involvement in the Yemen civil war because we've been helping out Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has been aiding one of the sides in the Yemen civil war. And so we're going, hey, we need to quit that. We need to quit helping out the Saudis on this. and what the pre- and you know, let's also be honest that it was the Saudis who and really the Saudi royal family ordered the murdering of Washington Post journalist Khashoggi. And so this is, you know, it's like, you know, how can we stand up for our values in our own country and let alone nationwide if we're going to help out a country that will kill our own journalists? And what the president did was that he vetoed that resolution. They couldn't override it. The Congress couldn't override it. So they're trying to get a vote on this nuclear, on this, I keep saying that word, on this arms deal with Saudi Arabia, and because they want some checks and balances on this. And I think what is ever so interesting is that it's not just the Democrats wanting it. This is bipartisan support trying to check the president's power on this particular issue.
Yeah, because I think, you know, maybe perhaps, comrade, you have watched too much Chernobyl. And all the word nuclear is in your brain. But the thing is that it is kind of a nuclear option. And this is what I mean. Most of the time when we talk about politics, the nuclear option is the one thing that you do towards the end of the deal, stagnating or not going according to your agenda. You basically nuke that deal. You do the nuclear option, one act that absolutely and defiantly changes the course of how this is going to go down. Our nuclear option, when it comes to, what is it, MBS, who is the Saudi prince, when it comes to him, when it comes to the deal itself, and all of the, and let's just go ahead and say this, Eisenhower warned us about these guys, all of the military industrial complex jobs in the United States that are dependent on these Saudi deals. These guys have kind of got Trump by the hand saying, look, you would be the best guy ever if you personally tell people, screw that, we're going to keep our business with Saudi Arabia. But even guys like Lindsey Graham, of all people, have come forward and said our business with Saudi Arabia should not be independent of our diplomatic policies towards Saudi Arabia. And that is where Trump is trying to go. He's basically saying, politics aside, they kill journalists, they suppress women, they are single-handedly leading a campaign of corruption within the Middle East that behooves them to keep up as they weaken their neighbors around them through dirty money and propping up terrorist groups. Yes, I said that Saudi Arabia does prop up terrorist groups for their own selfish needs. But with all of this stuff going on, we can't forget about it when the checks and the invoices start to come back and forward. That was Lindsey Graham's approach. And for the longest time, people thought, I'm not making this up, Lindsey Graham was the only sane guy on the GOP.
You know how crazy that actually sounds.
Right. This is a guy that I don't think has come to terms with things in his own household and life yet. Yet, he still seems observant enough to tell us, my God, this seems a little wrong.
You know, when Lindsey Graham, you know, senator from South Carolina, actually disagrees with the president, and you know, that should really send a signal, because he has been one of the biggest sympathizers. That's true. I don't have any other word other than that.
No.
For this president. I mean, he's been on his side ever since he took the oath of office. And you can go back and you can go look at his older tweets, his older social media posts about if the Republicans nominate him and it's going to be a bloodbath and we deserve it. And you can go and look at old interviews that he did throughout the media and saying, you know, calling, you know, President Trump a loon, a kook, all of these types of things. And you throw it in his face and he's like, yeah, so what? You know, I'm a big supporter of President Trump. And I mean, he is just pretty much a lapdog for the president. And for him to jump off the lap and growl at the president to say, hey, you're wrong on this, that's an interesting note. And you have other Republicans who have sided with him, you know, even the one who's in charge of the Republican parties in the Senate anyway. Their reelection committee, that's Todd Young out of Indiana, saying, hey, look, you know, we need a bipartisan approach on this. We have to check the power of the president on this particular deal. So, yeah, it's a bit of a red flag whenever the president is unilaterally doing this, and even members of his own party are even kind of, you know, whacking him on the head, wagging their finger and telling him, no, you really shouldn't do this. You need our support on this.
Yeah, because here's the thing. One of the if Lindsey Graham is defender in chief of the president, then Mitch McConnell is enabler in chief. Can we agree on that statement? Enabler in chief. Is that a title?
It is now, and he definitely deserves it.
Okay, so with enabler-in-chief Mitch McConnell, let's talk about his role in this as well. Because behind the scenes, when Khashoggi was first assassinated, when there was not even proof that the Saudis did it, but mere allegation that MBS was behind this, Mitch McConnell already had put the president on notice of saying, we have to deal with the Saudi Arabia situation. Now, a lot of people thought, wow, that's a weird thing, Mitch McConnell having a soul. But
yeah.
This wasn't the only time this happened. When the evidence came out that, in fact, Khashoggi was a part of a state-sanctioned hit job, that hit job came straight from the Saudi prince. And when confronted by our very own ambassador of everything, Wonderboy Jared Kushner, MBS basically told him, we kill people all the time. What's the big deal? That was actually the quote, by the way. What's the big deal? So Mitch McConnell at that point came forward and said, a big deal is I have to get reelected in a place like Kentucky. And, I mean, that's not what he really said. He said actually something about virtue and, yeah, okay, but it was really about
stuff
his real.
He doesn't have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know, soul of a name. Yeah, okay, compassion, these things that he lacked. But he did make a statement basically saying at that time he disagreed with the president. And the president making that, remember the press release in all caps, jobs first.
Yep.
Remember that? America first, right at the end of it in big capital letters.
Every time.
Well, when McConnell saw that, he kind of just looked at it and harumphed, because that's what you do at that age. And after a good harumphing was had, he basically told the president, look, me and you are going to come to a very public disagreement if you keep bringing this item forward. In other words, Mitch McConnell said, shut your mouth and play your role, because you're going to mess up my plan. What was their plan? Of course, stacking the judiciary. And if any sort of unscrupulous type of intention came their way, that could have halted McConnell's plan, which he was, at that moment, at lightning fast pace, getting these deeply conservative judges to federal lifetime appointment. Now, with that said, Donald Trump, once again, continued to ignore all of this professional harumphing and a little bit of some Southern chideness with, bless your heart, what kind of idiot? I said, what kind of idiot does business with Saudi Arabia? Despite all of that kind of stuff, Trump pressed forward. And even though we've seen kind of a wax and wane of Lindsey Graham, of I support the president on this area, but not in this area, this seems to be something that a lot of the GOP is absolutely saying a bridge too far is about to be crossed. We need to stop this deal. Now, how much pressure, though, from the rest of the world is the United States realistically under not to do business with Saudi Arabia?
You know, I got to think about that. And, you know, it's kind of tough. I really don't have an idea, to be honest, but my initial gut feeling is, you know, they probably are under a lot of pressure to not do this type of thing because of, you know, alienating allies. If Saudi Arabia kills people all the time, and what's the big deal? Who's to think that it wouldn't just be Americans? It could be others. So look, you know, this is here's what we're dealing with here. It seems rather plain and simple, like very straightforward. But this president doesn't like to do things very straightforward. He likes to do things in his own world and how he can maximize, profit for whether people who donated to his campaign or other types of aspects that have to do with jobs and other things like that. He seems to be more focused on somebody else making a big buck as opposed to American values and protecting the First Amendment and protecting the Constitution. So
should we be surprised, though, because this is a guy that called journalists the enemy of the state? He has actually venerated, I guess, is it venerated? He has actually venerated Erdogan for him suppressing his media and has shown immense admiration to Chairman Kim and President Putin for how they deal with media. Is this as light of an issue as people around Trump tried to make it out to, or is this the pattern of a guy that says, if I couldn't kill Jamal Khashoggi, well, good thing that the Saudis got him for me.
Yeah, I think it's the latter than the former. And that's sad. That's incredibly, incredibly sad. I mean, this is, you know, President Trump doesn't like his media coverage, so he attacks the media. Yeah, he calls everybody. If there's anything negative about him, it's fake news. He doesn't ever can take any type of criticism, you know. The same network that praises him in this past 4 years just went to the absolute ringer under President Obama. They questioned his citizenship. They actually took segments to deal with aspects of his nationality. They even stated that his birth certificate was fraudulent. They brought in Trump all the time to talk about this sort of thing. They constantly attacked him every chance that they got. And did Obama want to shut down Fox News, and did he go after them, and did he call them fake news and all that sort of stuff? No, he didn't. I mean, he probably had his little spats with Rush Limbaugh, and I'm, truth be told, every person who has a brain should. But that being stated, he never said that those people are fake, right? Nor did he say journalists are the enemy of the people and all this and that. When things are good for Trump, he loves Fox News. Someone criticizes him on Fox News, it's like he wants them to be fired or maybe be Khashoggi'd. It's incredibly sad.
Yeah.
And this, you know, you asked me if this is a real shock that he doesn't really support the First Amendment unless it supports him. No. But, you know, we should expect more from the president. And I can't believe I actually said that, especially including this president. But, you know, he took an oath to swear. He took an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of both enemies, foreign and domestic. And there's a lot of discussion whether or not he's actually upholding his constitutional obligations and if he obstructed justice and other types of things.
You know, this is the thing, because I kind of want to sidetrack here real quick with something that you brought up. Donald Trump does have an immense love of Fox News. But he also has a lot more love here lately for something called One America News.
Yeah.
Now, if you're somebody that has like a DirecTV type service, you probably are familiar with the very hard-lined, right conservative news network. These guys are to the right of Fox News and just slightly, slightly toe in bed with the same kind of logic that NRTV functions from. However, because they have made a full-out multi-thousand-dollar investment as of lately just to put on a charm offensive for the president has started referencing them in his speeches, much the same as he used to do in the early days with Fox News. Dangerous question here. Are conservative news media vying to be the president's choice of news provider?
Yeah. I don't think that's dangerous. Well, not only is it dangerous, but it's also true. And I think, yes, I think they are. You don't hear anybody, you don't hear Trump talk about Glenn Beck or the Blaze. You don't hear him talk about really a whole lot about Limbaugh. I mean, you'll hear him, reference Mark Levin. He doesn't talk about you, doesn't talk about me. He's referencing One American News. I think next you might even see Russian Today, RT, mm-hmm. Which is another, one of these weird news networks. But yeah. And we use that term news when describing them as loosely as possible. But, it's like he just can't get enough of the attention. And I mean, truth be told, when you're president, you get a lot of attention, and that just goes with the territory. But it's like anybody who has a negative thing to say about him is just suddenly wrong, and should be demeaned in some way. But truth be told, they're an American patriot for even asking a question that might be against what he's thinking. That's part of being a public figure. Look, this is, he's dished out his fair share of criticism. He even asked the question when Obama was president, if you can impeach a president for incompetence. That hasn't aged well, for him anyway.
Just going to throw this out there. No.
Yeah. I kind of wish we could say yes so that we can get this guy out, but this is the world that we're living in now. It's incredibly different than, 8 years ago.
Yeah, because, see, here's the thing. With this latest kind of push, senators now are actually being questioned which is more important. Loyalty to the cult of personality of Donald Trump, which, let's just not go ahead and handicoat this in any way, shape, or form, has paid off royally for the GOP for the last 2 years. Being in the cult of Trump has actually benefited the GOP. But now that the cult of Trump is starting to go toxic and a little crazy, it does seem that senators are now pulling themselves back from the brink and going, oh my God, I almost took a sip of that Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So, Drew, here's the thing. It's okay for there to be murmurs around the edges. And I mean, I understand that, too, and we'll talk about this in a sec on the Democratic side, the pressure from them. But when it comes to the GOP right now, is there enough of an incentive to break from the cult of personality of Donald Trump for them to do the right thing with their oversight?
On this Saudi Arabia deal, yes. On anything else, no. Mitch McConnell's up for re-election. We'll see how that plays out for him. If he comes back to Washington in 2021, then we'll have a definite answer as to whether or not it did play out for him. And if he returns with Trump, then the answer to that question is a resounding yes. If they're both sent packing, the answer is no. So, but as of right now, when it comes to the issue of Saudi Arabia, Yeah. You know, we have to look at that being doing the right thing. But Juan, really any other thing? No.
No, no. And see, that's just it because, you know, we've got like 4 minutes here left in the show, and I kind of want to just go to this part because with all of these people that have come up thus far and have been like, yay, president, it seems like now we're at a different stage. And last week, that stage took kind of a dramatic turn under the guise of Democrats. Now going forward to Pelosi and saying, you know what? You got to quit playing, girl. You got to quit playing. This is done. Done. I want some sanity. And that's what a lot of people inside of the House and even some Democratic senators have come up and said, listen, Speaker Pelosi, you're actually being very dangerous about not opening up any sort of impeachment talk right now. And Nadler, Jerry Nadler, the guy that the president has given a nickname to, little Jerry Nadler, he's given a nickname to Nadler, of course, sits on one of the committees that has been going after Trump's tax returns. Nadler, who has been one of Pelosi's biggest supporters, is now coming forward and saying, you know what, Nancy, everybody's right. Now I'm breaking with you and calling for impeachment. Drew, how long before the levee called Pelosi break?
Yeah, that's a great question. Nadler was one of her biggest supporters, big defenders on that. A lot of her, for lack of a better term, lieutenants were also saying, look, you got to be patient with this. You have to be prudent in this type of scenario. Understand that. But when the Mueller, when he himself, Bob Mueller, explained his report and said, I could not give him any type of charge dealing with obstruction because of a DOJ rule, but somebody outside of the whole aspect of the judicial system, meaning AKA Congress, you need to do it now. That was the biggest kiss send-off I've seen in politics ever. I mean, that was just like, hey, look, I can't do this. It's your job. And if Pelosi is feeling the heat, it's because that other members in the Democratic Party are saying, because Mueller said that we should, and he's the guy who ran the investigation. Now, what's ever so funny about this is that the Republicans in their own chamber are saying, well, we need to do other things. We need to do infrastructure. We need to do immigration. Listen here, you little weirdos. You had 2 years of your own time to do this sort of thing, and you did nothing with it. So don't be blaming this on the Democrats. You had a full House and Senate with your own party. You could have done something on immigration. You could have done something on infrastructure. You chose not to. So it's not the Democrats' fault on this, and that's what they have to be reminded when they bring this up. But in short, yes, she's feeling the heat. She's going to have to make some sort of a response on this.
Yep, and will she do it? We'll find out this week as the news rolls on. Until then, though, that's it for this show. Love you, mean it. Kaden, bye.